Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, The Paradise Snare, Book One of the Han Solo Trilogy by A.C. Crispin. Ancient troop ship, a relic of the Clone Wars, hung in orbit over the planet Corellia, silent and seemingly derelict. Looks were deceiving, however. The old Liberator-class vessel, once called Guardian of the Republic, now had a new life as Traitor's Luck. The interior had been gutted and refitted with a motley assortment of living environments, and now contained nearly 100 sentient beings, many of them humanoid. At the moment, only a few of them were awake, since it was the middle of the sleep cycle. Garrus Shrike, leader of the loosely allied trading clan that lived aboard the Luck, was not a man to cross without a good reason and a fully charged blaster. A slender man of medium height, Garrus was handsome in a hard-edged way. Streaks of silver white above his temples accentuated his black hair and ice-blue eyes. His mouth was thin-lipped. He seldom smiled, and never with good humor. At the moment, Shrike was sitting around the table in the former wardroom of the enlisted officers, playing sabacc and drinking tankards of potent Alderaanian ale. One of his fellow players, Brayfid, a hulking Eloman with two bulbous eyes protruding from the sides of his head, suddenly glanced behind him. Brayfid grunted.
Something funny about the lockout sensor on the weapons cache, Captain. It's reading normal now, but something flickered as though the lock shorted out for a second. Probably just a momentary power flux.
The captain rose and walked around the table to study the readouts himself. Somebody shorted out the lock and is running a sim to fool us into thinking it's just a power flux. We've got a thief aboard. He turned to a tall, heavy-set human.
Lared, activate the biosensor. See if you can ID the thief and where he's heading.
Lared, Shrike's brother, nodded and bent over the auxiliary control board.
Corellian human, he announced after a moment. Male. Height, 1.8 meters. Dark hair and eyes. The bioscanner says it recognizes him. He's heading aft, toward the galley.
Shrike's expression hardened until his eyes were as cold and blue as the glaciers on Hoth. The Solo kid. He's the only one cocky enough to try something like this.
Han Solo gripped the stolen blaster as he tiptoed along the narrow metal corridor. When he'd wired into the sim and jimmied the lock into the weapons cache, he'd only had a moment to grab the first weapon that came to hand. Nervously, he pushed strands of hair back from his forehead. The blaster felt heavy and awkward in his hand. Han had seldom held one before, and he'd never actually fired a weapon. He crept up to the door of the galley and hesitated. He heard the soft clatter of metal pans, then the splooch of dough being kneaded. Sticking the blaster into his belt, he opened the door and stepped into the galley.
Hey, Dulana, it's me. I've come to say goodbye.
The Wookiee, who had been vigorously kneading the wastrel dough, swung around to face him. Dulana's real name was Dulana Mapia, and she had been Han's closest friend since she'd come to live aboard Traitor's Luck nearly 10 years ago, when he had been about 9. Shrike had found Han when he was 5 years old, homeless and begging in an alley, and put him to work with the other charges aboard the Luck. Each child aboard Trader's Luck was given an elementary-level education so he, she, or it could learn to count money. Beyond that, Shrike discouraged the children from pursuing higher learning. Partly because he wanted to flout Shrike's wishes, and partly due to Dulana's encouragement, Han had kept up his studies in secret. Once Dulana discovered what he was doing, she monitored his curriculum, making him study subjects he would have otherwise skipped. Reluctantly, Han tackled reading, math, the physical sciences, and history. Han couldn't speak Wookiee, but he understood it very well. For her part, Dulana couldn't speak Basic, but she understood it as well as she did her own language. So communication between the human youth and the elderly Wookiee widow was fluent, but different.
Han
nodded. Yes, tonight's the night. I'm getting off Traitor's Luck, and I'm never coming back. Even as Dulana rumbled at him worriedly, she automatically resumed kneading her dough. Han gave her a lopsided grin. You worry too much, Dulana. Of course I've got it all planned. I'm heading for Yalicia. There's a robot freighter headed there. It's a religious colony near Hutt Space, and they offer pilgrim sanctuary. I'll be safe from Shrike there, and... He held up a small holodisk. Look at this! They're advertising for a pilot! Impulsively, the Corellian youth threw himself against her warm, solid bulk, hugging her fiercely. I'm gonna miss you, too. You take care of yourself, Dulana.
Well, ain't this a touching sight? Said a cold, all-too-familiar voice. Han and Dulana wheeled to face the man who'd entered. Garrus Shrike lounged in the doorway. Larid Shrike and Brayfid the Elaman were visible over Shrike's shoulder. Han licked dry lips. Listen, Captain, I can explain. Shrike drew himself up, his eyes narrowing. You can explain what, you cowardly little traitor? Stealing from your family? Stabbing your benefactor in the back? But I've had it with you, Solo. I've been lenient with you so far because you're a blasted good swoop pilot and all that prize money came in handy. But my patience is at an end. Han gulped with terror as Shrike started toward him. He'd lashed out at the traitor captain once before, 2 years ago, when he'd been feeling cocky after winning the gladiatorial free-for-all on Jubilar, and had been instantly sorry. With a snarl, Dulana stepped forward. Shrike's hand dropped to his blaster. You stay out of this, old Wookiee. Your cooking isn't that good. Han had already grabbed his friend's furry arm and was forcibly holding her back. Dulana, no! She shook off Han's hold as easily as she would have waved off an annoying insect and continued heading toward Shrike. The captain drew his blaster. Han leapt forward. No! His foot lashed out in an old street fighting technique. His instep impacted solidly with Shrike's breastbone. The captain's breath went out in a great hoof, and he went over backward. Han hit the deck and rolled. A tingler bolt sizzled past his ear. As Dulana started toward him, the captain wheezed, Larid! Shrike's brother drew his blaster and pointed it at the Wookiee. Stop, Dulana! His words had no more effect than Han's. Dulana was in full Wookiee battle rage. She grabbed Larid's wrist and yanked, spinning him around and snapping him in a terrible parody of a child's snap-the-whip game. Han heard a crunch as tendons and ligaments gave way. Larid Shrike shrieked. Grabbing the blaster from his belt, Han snapped off a shot at the Elaman who was leaping forward, Tingler aimed at Dulana's midsection. Brayfid howled in agony and dropped to the floor. Shrike staggered to his feet, blaster aimed squarely at Han's head. Stop it, Dulana, or your buddy Solo dies. Han dropped his blaster and put his hands up in a gesture of surrender. Dulana stopped in her tracks, growling softly. Then she shoved Han aside and leapt for Shrike. The blaster's energy beam caught her full in the chest and she went down. Dulana! Han yelled in anguish. With a quickness he hadn't known he possessed, he dived at Shrike, hitting the captain in a driving tackle around his knees. Shrike went over backward again, and this time his head impacted solidly with the deck. He sagged. Out cold. Han crawled back to his friend, turning her over gently, seeing the great hole the blaster beam had bored into her chest. He knew immediately that the wound was mortal. Han clutched her. No, I won't leave you. Tears blurred his vision. I don't care if I get away. Yeah, I'm sure you'll be safe. One with the life power. Han tried to sound sincere. He knew that some Wookiees believed in a unifying power that bound all of existence together. He'd never been able to translate the term accurately. The Wookiee word could have meant strength or force. Personally, he thought it was just superstition. Finally, Han gave way to her pleas. I promise. I'll go now. And I swear I'll always remember you, Dulana. He laid her gently on the deck, then rose and picked up the blaster. His running feet resounded through the corridors of Trader's Luck. The time for stealth was past. He had to reach the docking bay and that robot Yalician freighter. He skidded around the final turn and grabbed the spacesuit he'd hidden behind some fueling equipment. He could hear the sounds of pursuit now, but nobody would guess he'd be crazy enough to try stowing away on a robot freighter. At least that's what he was counting on. The airlock hissed open. Han leapt inside, closed the hatch, and began yanking on the spacesuit. He checked the air storage. Full. Good. He'd planned to bring along some extra air packs, but he didn't dare venture back out. The freighter was crowded with equipment and cargo, and the corridors were very narrow. The Dream wasn't constructed to accommodate a living crew, and Han had to turn sideways to squeeze into the bridge, where he froze. What in the name of all the sons of Barab is an astromech droid doing on the bridge, he thought. Everyone knew an astromech couldn't pilot a ship by itself. The Dream shuddered. Quickly, Han edged away from the bridge and headed back toward the cargo area. Finally, he found what he was looking for, and just in time. A small space, just the right size to allow him to brace himself with his arms and legs. Wham! Han's body jerked, then he braced himself against the thrust of violent acceleration. The Dream was undocked and away. Han Solo took a long, deep breath of canned spacesuit air. Hey, Dulana, I'm on my way. I'm going to Yalicia, and I'm going to become a pilot. I'll learn enough and earn enough to apply for the Academy the way we always dreamed. I'm free. We're safe. And Troy can't touch either of us now. When Han awoke from exhausted sleep, he was completely disoriented at first. Then memory came rushing back in swift, violent images. Han's mind drifted back in time, remembering Dulana sadly. Then his mind wandered back to even earlier days when Shrike had first taken him aboard the Luck. Han stirred and shook his head. I should never have gone with him that day, he thought. If I hadn't gone with him, Dulana would still be alive. But if he hadn't gone with Shrike, he'd probably have awakened some night in the alley to find that Vrelts had chewed his ears and nose off the way they had one of the other alley urchins that Garrus Shrike had rescued. Han smiled grimly. Captain Shrike didn't have an altruistic bone in his body. He collected children and used them to turn a profit. At almost every planet the Luck visited, Shrike loaded up a group of his rescuees and took them down to the streets in the shuttle. There he left them under the supervision of a droid he'd specially programmed, F8GN. HGN assigned them to their territories and kept track of their proceeds as the children roamed the streets, begging and pickpocketing. Han could still hear HGN saying,
Now, dear children, have you all got your territory assignments?
The copper-colored droid swiveled its head a little rustily on its pipe-stem neck, regarding the 8 children from Trader's Luck as they stood ranged before it. All of the children, including 5-year-old Han, affirmed that they did, indeed, have their territories.
Very well then, dear children. Let me now give you your job assignments. Padra?
The droid looked down at a small boy only a year or so older than Han.
Today we're going to give you your first chance to show us how helpful you can be to these poor citizens who are burdened with credit vouchers, jewelry, and expensive private comlinks.
The droid's eyes glittered eerily. They were different colors. One had burned out long ago, and Shrike had replaced it with a lens scavenged from a junked droid, giving F8GN one red eye and one green.
Are you willing to help out these poor, benighted citizens, Padra?
Sure am,
the boy cried. He gave Han and the other small children a triumphant glance.
No more baby begging for me!
Han had felt a stir of envy. It was far easier to meet 8GN's quota for a day's work picking pockets than it was by begging. Pickpocketing. That was the way to earn big money. If you refused to work for Shrike by begging or stealing, you didn't eat. Han had no other skills to offer. He was too little to pilot, not strong enough to load smuggled cargo.
But I won't always be, he had reminded himself. Soon I'm going to be big, and just 5 more years I'll be 10, and then maybe I'll be big enough to pilot.
Once he'd confided his dream to one of the other children, and the little Vrelt blabbed it to everyone. Shrike and the others laughed at Han for weeks, calling him Captain Han of the Imperial Navy. Han didn't know how he happened to be in that alley when Shrike found him. He didn't know if he'd been abandoned by his parents or if they'd died. The captain kept telling him that if he was good,
If he worked and begged hard, if he earned enough credit, someday Shrike would tell him the secrets behind how he'd come to be wandering the streets of Corellia that day. Now, hauling himself up out of his cubbyhole, the young pilot made his way through the cramped passageways until he reached the bridge. The astromech droid was still there, its lights flashing away. It was a relatively new R2 unit, still shiny bright silver and green with a clear dome atop its head. It was hooked into the ship's robot controls by means of a cable. The droid must have been equipped with a motion sensor because it swiveled its domed head toward Han as he clumped boldly onto the bridge in his spacesuit. Han activated his suit communicator. Hey, you! Han cursed. What am I going to do now? If only you had a basic speech module. The droid answered in a matter-of-fact voice. But I do, sir. There was a pause. I regret, sir, that you are guilty of unauthorized entry, sir. I know that. I hitched a ride on this ship. I beg your pardon, this unit does not understand the term used, sir. Han called the R2 unit an uncomplimentary name. I beg your pardon, this unit does not understand. Shut up! Han bellowed. The R2 unit was silent. Han took a very deep breath. Okay, R2, I am a stowaway. Is that word in your memory banks? Yes, it is, sir. Good. I stowed away aboard this ship because I needed a ride to Yalicia. Now I'd like to check on our flight path, speed, and ETA to Yalicia. Please display that information. I regret, sir, that I am not authorized to give you that information. Han struggled to keep his voice calm. Listen carefully, R2. Don't you have some kind of operating systems program that orders you to attempt to preserve the lives of intelligent beings whenever you can? Yes, sir, that programming is included with all astromech droids. That fit in with what Han knew about astromech programming. Listen to me, R2. If you don't show me our flight path, speed, and ETA, you may be responsible for my death from lack of air. Do you understand me now? It whirred once, then said, I will comply with your request, sir. As Han studied the figures and diagram that appeared on the screen, he felt his uneasiness grow into real fear. Yalician Dream's flight path had been set to take it on a circuitous route to the planet in order to avoid the worst of the pirate-infested areas of Hutt space, and the little freighter's speed was set far lower than the ship was capable of. Not good. Not good at all. Han turned back to the R2 unit. Listen, if I don't alter our course and speed, I won't have sufficient air to make the trip. I'll die, and it'll be your fault. The R2 unit's lights flashed as the machine contemplated this revelation. Sir, my programming is in conflict with my hardware. I am constrained from assisting you. Han took one huge stride over to the droid and pounded his fist on top of the clear dome. Blast you! I'll die! Tell me! I have been fitted with a restraining bolt, sir. It prevents me from complying with your request. Han seized on this bit of information with alacrity. After a moment, he spotted the restraining bolt low down on the droid's metal carapace. He grasped it and tugged. The bolt didn't move. Suddenly, he remembered the blaster. Shooting a blaster inside a spaceship, even an unpressurized spaceship, wasn't a good idea, but Han was desperate. He examined the settings. Lowest setting, he thought. Narrowest beam. Aiming and narrowing his eyes, he squeezed delicately. A flash of energy erupted, and the little droid responded so shrilly it sounded like a scream. The restraining bolt fell to the deck, leaving behind a black burn on the otherwise shining metal of the R2 unit. Han inspected his work with satisfaction. Gotcha. Now, R2, be good enough to point me toward the manual interfaces and controls in your ship here. Following the droid's instructions, he wrenched off the top of the featureless control panel and studied the tiny bank of controls. Cursing at the awkwardness of trying to manipulate the controls while wearing spacesuit gloves, Han disengaged the hyperdrive. Once they were back in normal space, he painstakingly computed a new course, using the R2 unit to perform the more esoteric calculations for the jump that would send them back into hyperspace. You realize, sir, said the droid, that you will now have to land this craft manually. Altering our course and speed has invalidated the existing landing protocols programmed into the ship. Han leaned wearily back against the console. Yeah, I know. But there's no other way. I just hope I can work the controls fast enough to land us. Hans sighed and closed his eyes. Dulana's loss was like a knife wound. No matter how he tried, he couldn't get away from the pain and the memories. He owed her his life. She had stood up to Shrike and insisted on taking him to a doctor when he had had a severe case of Corellian Tanaman fever. He even owed her his true identity. Until he was 11 years old, his only name had been Han. Han often wondered about his last name. One night, when Shrike was drunk and in a good mood over his Sabacc winnings, Dulana casually asked him about Han's identity, and the captain had said his name was Solo. From then on, Han took every opportunity to try to trace his family. Every so often, Shrike would run a major scam on rich folks on Corellia. Han had been part of the background during several cons. Shrike would rent a wealthy estate on Corellia and then set up a family unit to provide a respectable backdrop to the scam. Han and the other children detailed to such a family would live on the estate and go to a rich kid's school. One of his jobs was to make friends with the children of the wealthy and bring them home to play. Several times this had resulted in valuable contacts whose parents had been duped into investing in Garrus Shrike's current scam. Shrike recruited Han frequently for his scam operations, partly because of the boy's easygoing charm and winning smile, and partly because Han's clandestine studies made him fit into his grade level better than most of the other children. Han had also gained a small reputation as an up-and-coming swoop and speeder pilot. On one of those visits, Han tracked down a family called Sal Solo and had met Thraken Sal Solo, a slightly older boy who closely resembled Han, conclusively establishing that they were related. Han had hoped to find a home with the Sal Solos, but the boy was a bully, and his widowed mother, Tion, was a fearful, untrusting recluse. However, Han did learn that he was probably the son of Tion's twin brother. The twins had been separated as infants when their parents, Han and Thraken's grandparents, had fled to escape from raiders. No one had heard from Tion's father or brother since. Thraken himself had notified Shrike of his cousin Han's whereabouts, and Han was returned to Trader's Luck and severely beaten. For a moment, Han wondered why it had never occurred to him to kill the unconscious Shrike before he'd made his getaway aboard the Elysian Dream. He'd have been doing the inhabitants of Trader's Luck a favor. He'd had the blaster in his hand. Han shook his head. He'd never shot anyone before yesterday, and killing an unconscious man just wasn't his style. But Han knew that if Garrus Shrike ever caught up with him in the future, he was a dead man. The captain never forgot, and he never forgave. He specialized in carrying grudges against anyone who had ever wronged him. Han got up to check their course and his air pack. Only a few hours' worth of air left now. He did some mental calculations while staring at the display. Close, he thought. It's going to be close. I'd better be ready to pop the cargo door on this crate as soon as we land. It's going to be very, very close. Although he'd flown hundreds of hours in swoops and speeders, Han's experience with piloting larger vessels was confined to the times Garrus Shrike had permitted him to pilot the Lux shuttle on easy runs. He'd never before tried to land anything as large as the robot freighter. The Elysian Dream headed down for the surface of a planet he couldn't even see. He glanced at the sensor readouts and the infrared scanners, though, and realized that Yalicia was a world of tempestuous air currents, even in the upper layers of the atmosphere. Mapping sensors created a global portrait of the planet. Shallow seas studded with islands and three small continents. The landing field was on the eastern continent. That must be where the colony of priests and religious pilgrims was located. The Dream rocked wildly, careening through the swirling air currents. Han forced the freighter into maneuvers only a swoop or military fighter could reasonably be expected to tackle. He realized he was gasping and wondered for a split second whether it was from stress and adrenaline or whether his air was running out. They were now only a kilometer above the surface of the planet, coming in with a rush. Too fast! Han slowed them, using the braking thrusters roughly. G-forces seized him, and he felt as though something were squeezing his chest in a giant vise. He was gasping steadily now, and he dared to look down at his air pack. Empty. The status indicator was solidly in the red zone. But they were almost slow enough now to land. Suddenly, the forward port side repulsor shorted out. The Dream yawed wildly to port, hit the ground, then bounced upward. the starboard repulsor blew, and then its entire starboard side impacted with the ground, nearly flipping the vessel over. Han was flung violently across the cabin. His helmet struck the bulkhead, and he lay there, arms and legs flung wide, dazed. He fought to stay conscious. If he passed out, he knew he'd never wake up again. The droid's mechanical tones sounded a bit shaken.
If you don't mind my saying so, sir, that appears to have been a most unconventional landing.
Han gasped for breath. Open the cargo airlock! When Han swam back up to full consciousness, he found he was in some kind of infirmary and staring into a face straight out of a nightmare. Only years of experience in dealing with non-humans of all varieties allowed him to control his initial reaction. The being's face was broad, with two bulbous, protruding eyes and covered with leathery, grayish-tan skin. No visible ears and only slits for nostrils. Above the nostril slits was a large, blunt horn that was nearly as long as Han's forearm. This creature's head was appended to a short, humped neck that was attached to a massive body. Then he noticed two undersized arms that were folded against its chest, half hidden by the loose folds of neck skin. The being's hands were delicate, almost feminine, with four long, supple fingers on each hand. The being spoke in accented but understandable basic.
Greetings, Drago. Allow me to welcome you to Yulisha. Are you a pilgrim?
Han's head was spinning. For a moment, the name didn't connect. But I'm not... Then things snapped into place. Vic Drago was the alias that appeared on all the ID he was carrying. Han had several alter egos, with proper documentation to back them up. Ironically, he had nothing by way of ID under his true name. He held his hand to his head. Sorry, I'm still kind of shaken up, I guess. No, I'm not a pilgrim. I came here to answer a job advertisement for a pilot.
Excellent. Drago, I am the most exalted high priest of Yulisha, Tiruenza. Welcome to our colony. I am impressed, young human, that you managed to control and land a robot craft. Few human pilots have been able to react quickly enough to deal with this world's challenging weather patterns.
Does that mean I get the job?
Would you be willing to sign a year's contract?
Quickly, the contracts were produced, and Han signed them, then allowed a retinal scan as proof of his identity. Han hoped they'd just do a general, system-wide check of his retinal patterns. If the priests ordered a comprehensive all-system search, they'd discover that Vic Drago, Jaina Sedanian, Talus Bryn, Janel Andrus, and Keel Detana all shared the exact same retinal patterns. With all of the business details taken care of, Tiruenza then summoned an underpriest, or Sacredo as they were called, and instructed him to take Han on a tour of the complex. The Sacredo introduced himself as Veritil and led Han outside. Han was instantly bathed in sweat. Steaming heat and humidity smote him like a physical blow. The air was rich with smells. Heavy perfume from flowers, rotting vegetation, and another odor, one he'd smelled before but couldn't quite identify. Pools of water attested to recent torrential rain. Reddish mud made an arresting contrast to lush, blue-green vegetation. The flowers hanging from the vines and trees in the encroaching jungle were huge and multicolored, scarlet, deep purple, and vivid yellow.
This is Colony One, Viratil explained. We also have established a new colony for our pilgrims several kilometers from here.
Across from the Welcome Center, massive ship-dock droids worked on the Elysian Dream, repairing her repulsors. To Han's left, he could make out a large expanse of the reddish mud. Several beings of Tiruenza's and Veritil's species lolled in mud holes, tended by droids and servants of assorted species. Veritil waved a dainty hand in their direction.
My people relish our mud baths.
What are your people? Are you native to Yulisha?
No, we are native, or as native as our distant cousins, the Huts, to Nalhutta. We are the Talanda Til.
Han resolved to learn the Talanda Til's language as soon as he could.
Knowing a language that people didn't know you knew could often prove an asset. The priest waved at a massive two-story building on the far left.
The multi-story buildings are where we process Ryl, Andris, and Karsunum. The single-story buildings you see extend far underground, a necessity for processing glitter stim, which must be handled in complete darkness.
Han's nostrils flared.
Of course, that explained the odor. These were factories for processing spice.
He remembered that the Elysian Dream had originally carried a cargo of high-grade glitter stim, the most expensive and exotic variety of spice.
Veritil went on with his explanation.
We receive shipments of raw materials from Kessel, Ryloth, and Nalhutta several times a month. In the beginning, the robot freighters who supplied us landed here at Colony 1, but they could not negotiate our tricky atmosphere. So we built a space station and decided to use living pilots to ferry the raw spice material down to the factories. We used to have 3 pilots, but now we are down to 1. And the unfortunate Sulistan, who is currently serving as our pilot, has been ill. That is why we need you, Pilot Drago.
Han saw figures entering and leaving the factory buildings. All wore tan-colored robes that came down below their knees and tan-colored caps that covered their hair. He gestured at the people. Factory workers? The Sacredo hesitated.
They are the pilgrims that have chosen to serve the oneness, the all, in our factories.
Oh, I see. He saw a lot of things now. And he had a bad feeling about what he was seeing. These pilgrims came here to attain religious sanctuary and wound up working in spice factories. I smell a vrelt, he thought. A dead one. The Elysian sun was far down in the sky by now, and throngs of workers were streaming toward a range of snow-capped mountains in the northeast. Veritil beckoned Han with one undersized hand.
It is time for the blessed pilgrims to attend devotions and to be exalted in the One. Render their prayers to the All. Let us take the path of oneness to reach the Altar of Promises. Come, Pilot Drago.
After a 20-minute walk, the group reached a large paved area that was fronted with a partially roofed structure supported by 3 monstrous pillars, which Veritil referred to as the Plain of Flowers. Han saw several of the Talanda Til assembled beneath the pillars, including one that he tentatively identified as Teruenza. They were ranged around a low altar carved from some translucent white stone that seemed to glow with an inner light. The faithful filed into ranks and stood waiting. Hans stood at the back, shifting impatiently. The high priest raised his tiny arms and intoned a phrase in his native language. The sacredos, including Veritil, echoed him. Han leaned closer to the nearest pilgrim, a Twi'lek.
What are they saying?
The Twi'lek translated.
The One is All. The All is One. We are One. We belong to the All. In service to the All, everyone is exalted.
Finally, after nearly 15 minutes of chanting, Teruenza and all the priests stepped forward. The high priest pronounced,
"You have worked well. Prepare for the blessing of exaltation."
The crowd made a sound of such greedy anticipation that Han was taken aback. Moving in a great wave as though they were truly one, they dropped to the pavement and lay there, arms and legs huddled beneath their bodies. All of the priests raised their arms. Han watched as the loose, wrinkled skin that hung below their throats inflated with air and began to pulse. A low, throbbing hum, or was it a vibration, gradually filled the air. Han's eyes widened as he felt something invade his mind and body. It rolled across him in a great wave. Emotional warmth, physical pleasure, it was all of that and more. Han staggered back off the permacrete until he was brought up short by the trunk of a giant tree. He hung onto the tree physically and himself mentally, refusing to let himself be sucked under with that wave. Then, as quickly as it had started, the sensation was gone. He was free. But it was obvious the pilgrims weren't. Their bodies writhed on the stone, moaning with happiness and pleasure. Sickened, Han looked at the priests. They obviously weren't affected as the pilgrims were.
So this is why these poor dupes stay, he thought.
The next morning, when Han stepped out of the infirmary where he had spent the night, the first person he saw was Teruenza. Han nodded pleasantly to his employer. Good morning, sir. The High Priest inclined his massive head.
And to you, Pilot Drago, allow me to present someone you are going to be spending a lot of time with during your employment with us.
The High Priest beckoned, and Han heard someone behind him. His first impression was of height, and the second was of sharp teeth and knife-like claws. The felinoid being stood nearly 3 meters tall, taller even than a Wookiee. Its facial fur was black, but its whiskers and chest fur were white. A curved knife hung on its belt, and a holstered blaster was strapped to its thigh. Sleek muscles rippled everywhere. The newcomer grinned, bearing even more sharp teeth.
Greetings.
Tirowenza introduced the being.
This is Merg. He's a Togorian. The Togorian reputation for honesty and loyalty is unparalleled. We've assigned Merg to be your bodyguard, Pilot Drago. On planet or off, Merg will accompany you everywhere. Isn't that correct, Merg?
Merg has given word of honor,
the Togorian affirmed. The High Priest folded his undersized arms across his massive body, and his mouth curved up in what almost appeared to be a mocking smile.
Merg is going to make very sure, Pilot Drago, that no matter where you go or what you do, you will be safe.
Han stared at the huge black-furred creature. Tirowenza's meaning was unmistakable. Step out of line and Merg will rip you in two. Tirowenza went on.
Merg will show you where your quarters are. Tomorrow we'd like you to begin ferrying goods and personnel back and forth between the colonies.
After Tirowenza left, Merg took Han to the administration building and led him to a small suite consisting of a bedroom, refresher unit, and a small sitting room. But where will you sleep? Han asked. As expected, Merg indicated the sitting room.
Merg here.
Han stared at the blaster in the Togorian's holster. I had a blaster when I came here, but I don't know where it is now. I'll need to ask about getting it back. Merg flexed his fingers and the retractable claws popped out.
High Priest say pilot not need blaster.
Han told his bodyguard that he'd like to tour the factories, and they set off down a corridor of the administration building where restricted access signs were posted in many languages. Suddenly, Han glimpsed something large and grayish gliding far down the corridor. He squinted into the dimness. Hey, what was that? He started after it at a good clip. Merg made a futile grab for his charge, but Han was quicker than the big alien and dodged. When he reached the junction of the corridors, Han turned to stare up the one where he'd glimpsed that flicker of gliding motion. His eyes widened. Hey, it is a hut, he thought. What's a hut doing here? There was no mistaking that huge slug-like form reclining on its repulsor lift sled. As he hesitated, Merg pounced on him as though he were a vrelt, tucked him under one muscled arm, and ran back down the corridor. Then Merg set Han back on his feet and flexed a hand under the Corellian's nose.
My people teach. Everyone entitled to one mistake. Pilot just have his.
Han eyed the claws that gleamed under his nose, sharp and shiny as razors. Yeah, I can see your point. Or rather, your points. Merg stared at the sharp, shining tips of his claws, then his muzzle lifted back from his fangs, and he made a low, mewling sound. For a moment, Han froze. Then he realized this was the alien's form of laughter. Evidently, Merg had caught the joke. Han managed a weak chuckle. So, how about we get some food, then check out those factories, eh, pal? He asked. While they ate, Merg told Han a little bit about his people. In Togoria, males and females, though equal, did not mix their societies. Males lived a nomadic hunting existence, flying over the plains on their huge domesticated flying reptiles called Mozgoths. The females lived in cities and villages and developed all the people's technology. Merg sighed.
Togorians, very emotional people, capable of great love, especially males. Great love is why Merg is here.
The huge alien looked so woeful that Han felt sorry for him. What's her name?
Mrav. Beautiful, beautiful Mrav. Must discover what happened to her.
Han took a sip of his Polanus ale. So, have you tracked her down?
Merg traced her from world to world to world. Merg lost her. Someone on Ord Mantell said he saw her board ship at spaceport. Merg check schedules, find out ship at many pilgrims on board. Merg take chance, come here. Priests say no Togorians here. Merg not know where else to go.
Han shook his head. That's sad, pal. I hope you find her. It's tough to lose people you love. After lunch, they headed down to the factories. Han sniffed the air, smelling the odor of the different spices mingling. The Rodian guard on duty gave them badges and infrared goggles so they could see in the dark. Han beckoned Merg toward the turbo lift. Let's go all the way down and see the really good stuff. Privately, Han was wondering whether he might be able to light-finger some of the tiny black vials. Selling a little glitter stim on the side in a port city would increase his credit account by leaps and bounds. 6 floors down, the turbo lift ground to a halt. Han and Merg entered a large room with long tables lining the walls and filling the aisles. Each table was a workstation, where a worker sat or crouched according to his, her, or its individual anatomy. Han and Merg went to the supervisor, a furred Deveronian female, and identified themselves. The supervisor waved a sharp-nailed hand at the room.
My workers are the most skilled in the colony. They have to measure and trim the fiber strands so each dose will contain the correct amount of spice. It is essential, but very difficult, to line up the fibers so precisely that they will all activate at the same moment when exposed to visible light.
Han stopped behind one of the human workers and watched in fascination as she separated threads of ebony-colored spice, aligning them with the utmost care. The threads curled around the worker's fingers, some of them as fine-spun as silk, but the tiny crystals made them incredibly sharp. One sharp-studded strand cut between the woman's forefinger and thumb. A thin line of blood welled from the deep gash. Han sucked in a breath. A few centimeters deeper, and the tendon in her thumb would have been severed. She muttered something in Basic, and freeing her hand, held it to stop the bleeding. Han froze as he heard her accent. This pilgrim was Corellian. She was bleeding profusely. He bent over her. You're hurt. Let me call the supervisor so she can fix you up. The girl, she was his age, possibly younger, started slightly, then looked up at him. No, please don't. If she sends me to the infirmary, I'll miss the exaltation. With a wry smile, she held out her hands. Her fingers, wrists, and forearms were crisscrossed with tiny slashes. Some were old and white and healed, but many were dark weals, still fresh and painful. As you can see, it happens all the time. Excuse me, but you're Corellian, aren't you? Han grinned. So are you. I'm Vic Drago, the new pilot. And you are? Her mouth tightened. I'm not really supposed to be talking. I'd better get back to work. Merg, who had been watching in silence, spoke up.
Worker is correct. Pilot must let worker return to work now.
The Corellian moved one step away but continued talking.
Okay, but what's your name?
She shook her head. We give up our names when we leave all worldly things for the spiritual sanctuary of Yelisha. Merg growled, showing his fangs. The woman's eyes opened wide in alarm.
I am Pilgrim 921.